Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker. On today's episode, we are looking back at a segment of episode 25, which focused on ATP 7-100.3, Chinese Tactics. Today, we will relook how the People's Liberation Army, PLA, thinks about multi-domain operations. That conversation leads straight into the PLA's views on information and information as a domain. We'll hear from the host, Major Rich Deagle. Also, Mr. Brad Marvel and Ms. Angela Williams from the TRADOC G2, and the CAD director, Colonel Retired Rich Creed. Of note, when we first published this episode, Mr. Creed mentioned that CAD was working on information doctrine. But now ATP 313, information, has been published. So check out episode 53 for more discussion on ATP 313. Let's join the conversation where Brad starts talking about the PLA's understanding of multi-domain operations.
Their understanding of multi-domain operations is very similar to ours, and they call it cross-domain operations. That's the at least the most common translation. They have a bunch of different names for it. They understand domains in the same way that we do. I don't think they're as codified as they are for the U.S., but it's basically the same idea. It's a discrete plane on which some sort of contest occurs, and their understanding of how to fight in a cross-domain or multi-domain environment is pretty similar. And the way I typically describe that is they try to build formations that don't have any clearly exploitable vulnerabilities in any domain, and also has the ability to detect an enemy vulnerability and then exploit it and create that window of opportunity that lets you do, gives you the freedom of action, gives you the room to maneuver or whatever. So it's real similar conceptually to how we see all of that stuff. And their approach to building units, their approach to how they've develop this understanding of mass task organization is all built around that basic concept. So it's all built around creating a unit that is very well hardened and very difficult to, that doesn't have any obvious weaknesses, and at the same time is able to detect what it needs to and make rapid decisions, work very quickly, short decision cycles and so on to exploit whatever opportunity is available. And it's a pretty coherent thing top to bottom. They have come up with what I think is a pretty solid operational concept, which it mirrors ours in a lot of ways. And how that might look on a battlefield, I mean, it's pretty wild to think about all of the stuff that is potentially available to everybody. In this, it wasn't that long ago that we could only engage things that we could see visually. That's in living memory. That was how battles were fought. And now we have the ability to influence a tactical operation from literally the other side of the world, either kinetically or non-kinetically. I don't know. I think it's going to be fascinating how this stuff develops over the next couple of decades, because it's a wild change from how warfare has been traditionally. And I think it's fascinating that both we and the PLA have kind of aligned our understanding of it, at least at this point in time. So I think that implies to a degree that we're dealing with a peer, that someone who thinks who is as sophisticated as we are when it comes to thinking about this stuff.
So I would throw this out there for either of you to answer. And I don't think I'm crossing any lines by bringing it up, but I think there's a certain amount of and it's true with all armies around the world, is they look at whoever the pacing armed forces are. So you can talk about air forces or navies too, right? But and they say, okay, well, these guys have been doing this for a long time. They're the dominant thing. So there's certain aspects of what they do that we want to mirror, because those are best practices, and why invent something from whole cloth when we can borrow other people's ideas, best practices. Our army's expert at that. We've been doing that throughout our history, right? So there's nothing abnormal there. But I think we have to be careful about not over mirror imaging and assuming, because, I mean, at least my limited readings indicate that whatever the Chinese armed forces do, it's unique to the Chinese context and their strategic goals, right? And so I talked about us having to be able to do everything across that range of military operations in an expeditionary fashion around the world. I mean, I'm not aware of any real Chinese strategic goals of conducting expeditionary offensive operations anywhere outside of 100 miles off their coast, right? Maybe potentially at Taiwan. But that's not what they're building themselves to do. And I think that gives them a certain advantage, right? Because you got to focus, right? I've got to focus in at most my near abroad. And that focus, at least for ground forces, is not global. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, they're expanding that understanding, if you will. They anticipate the need for a global or at least semi-global expeditionary capability over the next 30 years or so, and they're building a force structure to support that. That's really the future role of the planned Marine Corps is as their expeditionary arm. And I think they're primarily looking at not just regionally, but Africa in particular, and the Middle East as spots where they may need to deploy conventional forces. And that's not something that China's ever been able to do. So that's a major shift in their, not just in the way they construct their military, but in their entire world view. And China under Mao is very insular and very, internally focused and so on. But the party now is very involved globally.
Sure.
Not just looking militarily, but their preference is to work with you economically or exploit you economically, depending on your viewpoint. So the way the PLA has changed, or particularly over the last 15 years or so, is I think with that in view. With that being said, I think you make a really good point about not mirroring. And the U.S. Army in particular, I think, is one of the worst organizations around at doing that. It's a cultural thing that we, as long as I've been around the Army, it's always been a thing. We tend to mirror. And with the PLA, it's appropriate in some cases. You know, there are a lot of similarities, but there are a lot of differences too. And one of the best ones I can give is their understanding of domains, as I said earlier, is pretty similar to ours, but there's a big difference. And they identify information as a domain, as a specific discrete domain, in the same way as space or ocean or land or whatever. And what I mean by information is not necessarily social media or that sort of cyber type stuff, if you will. But they call it the cognitive battle, or it's a little bit of a loose translation, but brain control. That's a focus of their entire system of warfare, is winning that information battle. And so much so, they consider the information domain to be the high ground. Like, that is they win that first. That is their first priority. And so the implications of that, when you're looking at how they build forces and train and so on, they're pretty significant. And that's a big difference. That's something that we haven't really adopted with the same level of enthusiasm. And I don't have any thoughts on who's right or wrong about that, but it is a big difference. And
well, that also has some correlations back again to traditional Chinese or classic Chinese exhibitory thought, with Sun Tzu being, The goal is to win without fighting.
Yeah, because yeah, the highest form of generalship and all. Yeah, that's a perfect example of that. And the follow-up to that that has been an ongoing theme throughout my involvement in this project is, how on earth do we replicate that in training? How that's something, you know, we are pros at replicating a maneuver on maneuver fight at anywhere you want to do it, any base, particularly at the CTCs, but that's something that we do it is well or better than anyone in the world. But how do you replicate that information kind of assault? How do you train soldiers to, how do you harden soldiers against that kind of thing? How do you train people to react to it? How do you counter it and so on? That's something that's a lot harder to answer. That's something you can't necessarily build a NTC to address. So it's something we have to build into our training model in a big way if we consider China to be the pacing threat and want to be ready to counter their number one effort, their main effort. That's something that's absolutely critical.
Yeah, they're focused on cognitive effects. So we've been discussing that. We're working on information doctrine right now. And we'll start with the big I, information writ large, along, you know, the different military applications. But it's our ultimate goal, though, is to get after doctrine for achieving cognitive effects. And we've been discussing back and forth where we ought to use that. I mean, instinctively, again, if you're of a certain age, you always understood that when you're executing operations, you're looking to generate both physical and cognitive effects. I think one of the challenges in training events is they're not long enough for those cognitive effects to be genuine, right? In other words, you got to make the training event so demanding, much like Ranger School or the Delta selection process, whereas you actually do get genuine psychological impacts from the operations. You know, what does it feel like to be isolated and cut off? You know, and there's consequences for that that are going to make me physically uncomfortable enough that I don't want to do that again. And so, I mean, I'd be interested in knowing, well, how do they do that, right? I know that's their goal, but how do they train that? I mean, I don't think they have unlimited resources to have 45-day brigade rotations at their combat training center. Well, maybe they do. I don't know.
Yeah, they struggle with it in the same way that we do. You know, particularly, I think it brings not only questions about training techniques and so on, but it raises some ethical concerns that are not necessarily, you know, that aren't in play when you're just doing a maneuver versus maneuver thing. Like what is the appropriate level of psychological pressure to put on a soldier in a training event, and how do we reconcile that? It's a hard question to answer, yeah. And I don't envy the doctrine people having to work that out.
Well, luckily we don't have to. We can just point suggestions. I mean, we can point things out, but I mean, the folks that are, you know, commanders that come up with training, well, all we can do is give suggestions. You were going to say something?
I would just say, aside from the training aspect, which I certainly don't have an answer to, something to consider in a way that information, psychological operations, that sort of thing is a leveler, is that how if an adversary implements some of these situations upon the U.S. Army, how we react to it is going to be different than how if we, you know, implemented some of these things on China or any other adversary. In terms of the U.S. Army has more policies and procedures in place and more concern for the individual soldier, perhaps, than some of our threat actors or our adversaries do. And so the effects might be more devastating, even though it's the same act. And, you know, some of these acts could be implemented by VEOs, violent extremist organizations. It doesn't cost a lot of money to, you know, maybe somehow contact a deploying unit and indicate somehow falsely that a soldier's spouse was in a devastating car accident right as they're to deploy. For instance, those effects are going to be potentially more dramatic on us than they would be on an adversary. And so that's something to consider that diverges the point a little bit. But, you know, when it comes to training on those things, I'm not sure how you can address them. But in real life, if those things were to play out, you know, that's something that any actor can implement at very little cost to great effect.
Well, we watched the Russians do that in Crimea and the Donbass.
Right.
I mean, that's not like theoretical stuff. That stuff that actually happens in real time.
So
how to prepare for that, I guess my point is I don't know, and that's a challenge that I think that we will always face. You can talk through it, but that's not the same as, you know, personally receiving that type of attack.
Yeah, so it's about resilience and building up a level of inoculation against these kinds of tactics and techniques and procedures, and just knowing that they're going to come, right? I mean, last thing you want is surprise. Surprise makes everything else worse.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.